session number 18191, Reel 4.
Right. So we decided that it might be prudent to take it home and have it looked at. And everything operated normally. There was no reason to really suspect trouble, but it was just considered wise, I thought, to check it before we went ahead with any more of this activity. And we landed back without any hassle, taxied in and parked, and discovered that the whole of the starboard inner flap section wasn't with the aeroplane anymore. There were four main flap sections, port inner and outer, starboard inner and outer, and they're pretty big chunks of stuff. I mean, you know, as big as a hunter's wing, this probably, getting on that way anyway, had just gone, and I didn't notice this on landing. But
You're in an asymmetric condition.
But okay, if I was holding up the right wing a bit, I didn't notice it. It was obviously very small, and we didn't notice any difference in any form of control over landing. Anyhow, what we realised was, of course, if it could do that, and this is with the flaps retracted, you must remember, they weren't hanging down where you might have thought they would have might be damaged with this. We considered the whole situation, and we had to discuss it with the ministry and with Boscombe Down and so on and so on. And it was decided, because we had this absolutely guaranteed natural pre-stall warning in all the configurations on the aeroplane, there was no need to go right ahead and do full stall trials, because we were only going to break aeroplanes up. And so stalling was abandoned for the Victor. And what happened was that in flight test on every individual aeroplane, for any form of experimental flight test and on production flight test, we flew them all down to third stage buffet just to make sure everything was absolutely normal, and then they were cleared for the Air Force to fly them down to second stage buffet. And that worked absolutely satisfactorily, no trouble at all, and no one ever had an accidental stall problem with the Victor. We didn't have to fit stick pushers or shakers or audio warning or anything at all.
It almost landed itself, didn't it?
Well,
or was that an exaggeration?
The prototypes would. Mm. But you've got to remember, the situation had to be ideal. In other words, you had to have either no wind or the wind straight down the runway. And you could set it up on the approach and trim it all out and take your hands off and just sit there, and yes, it would come down and sit on the ground. It would just flare gently and sit on the ground very, very nicely, and then you had to take control again, of course, to keep it straight on the runway and the rest. But Sir Frederick and the firm in general tried to make a big thing of this, but I mean, you had a crosswind or turbulence or anything like that, you couldn't do it. It was and the chances of having calm conditions and or wind absolutely straight down the runway are very few and far between, by comparison with all the other cases that you can have. And so whilst it was a super thing and you could demonstrate this to anybody you liked on the prototypes, it really didn't work on the production aeroplanes, because the fin was shorter on the production aeroplanes and the tailplane was lower, and it changed the whole ground effect problem. What happened simply was that the ground effect, as it came close to the ground, the wing was supported, and because the wings were supported and held a little bit off the ground, the tail sank, and the ground effect on the tail happened at just the right moment, so that it held the aeroplane in just the precise position to land on. But when the fin was shorter, the ground effect on the tail happened sooner, and so it pitched it forward a little bit, you see, and the whole thing was gone. You had to fly it.
Yeah.
And I think the Air Force were highly relieved that that happened, quite frankly.
Now, another thing I wanted to ask you about, I think Jock Still sorted this out, but You had tailplane flutter, didn't you? And then you had these out-of-balance exciters and the rear fuselage to dampen out flutter. Was that incorporated in the production aircraft?
Oh, no. No, the out-of-balance device was to precipitate flutter, not to stop it. Yes, you see, we don't know that we ever had flutter on the Victor, but it is conceivable that flutter was combined with the tail coming off the first prototype, because with the weakened attachment point, it is just conceivable that fluttered, and it was the flutter that took it off. Or it may have just broken clean anyway, but I don't think anybody's absolutely certain of what the story was there. But it was always a consideration, and always flutter with that tail had been thought about from the very beginning. It wasn't something that happened down the line. And so we had to do a pretty extensive flight flutter program. I started it with the second prototype. I never flew the first prototype. I started it with the second prototype a bit before Jock Still arrived. But a flutter program is, of course, a very gentle thing. You go into it very, very carefully. You start at the lowest speed ends and the easiest conditions, and you work gradually up watching it. And the way it was basically done was that we had a device in the tail end. And to explain it most easily, it simply had a flywheel with an offset blob to put it out of balance on the edge of it, you see. And you could run this thing from an electric motor at a variable speed to get the frequency you wanted going. And you could stop it dead. And so what you did with it was to run it, get the tail to be oscillating, and we could watch the oscillation in the front of the aeroplane because we had an oscilloscope to watch this wretched thing. And you could see it happening. And then you could stop the wheel absolutely abruptly, stop it dead. And then you measured what oscillation was left in the aeroplane. Well, of course, you progress from the lowest speed end very, very carefully up through this, and the aeroplane's dead beat. There's nothing. When you stop the wheel, the aeroplane stops too. There's nothing to excite it anymore. But as you get nearer and nearer the top end of the speed range, of course, you are left with some residual motion in the aeroplane. And you measure this, and each time you plot it and so on. And this was being heavily monitored by Farnborough. In fact, whilst we were doing it, all of this work had its records and returns sent Farnborough for analysis. So I started that program in the first prototype, the second prototype, a bit before Jock Still arrived with us. But when he arrived, it coincided more or less with the first flight of the first production aeroplane. That he took over that flutter program and went on and on doing it for quite a long time. And I was then much more heavily involved with the production aeroplanes, the production Mark 1s, in its development phase. During this time, Jock Still and I used to fly together quite frequently in production aeroplanes for various reasons. And on one occasion, I was flying one of the production aeroplanes. I landed at Radlett and clipped with the main undercarriage the very edge of the runway. The wheels really probably just went into the grass, perhaps a foot short of the beginning of the runway, and the runway stood a bit proud of the grass, and when the wheels hit the runway edge, it thumped the aeroplane quite severely, and Jock Still was wrapped in the back by a bar across the back of his bang seat, they had a funny hinged pan with a parachute in, and this hinge bar wrapped him in the back. Now, I don't know why it didn't do it to me, but after we got out of the aeroplane and we went to debriefing, I suddenly realised Jock wasn't with us. I said, where's Jock gone? Nobody knew. And we went and found him in the changing room, lying down on a bench. I said, what's the matter, Jock? He said, I got a terrible pain in my back. He said, it happened when we landed. Anyhow, of course, we was hooked off to the docks very quickly. And I'm not quite sure how the sequence went then for a while, but he was back to flying in 10 days or 2 weeks, something like that, and he carried on with his work on the Flutter program. And then one day, not long after this, he was flying a production aeroplane. It wasn't the Flutter aeroplane. He was flying a production aeroplane, and he did exactly the same thing as I did. He landed just short of the runway and hit this proud runway end again, and did it to himself again. But this time it was a whole lot more severe, and he never flew again.
Was he sitting in a different seat at this time?
He changed from... He was in the first pilot seat instead of the co-pilot seat.
The one you'd been sitting in
previously. Yes, but I don't... Well, it would have been...
But
they were identical seats. Yeah. It made no difference. Yeah. And they were identical seats whichever side of the aeroplane you were sitting, you see. But anyhow, after this one, you could stick pins in his leg and he couldn't feel it. His legs were numb. He could still walk and things, but he'd lost all feeling. And he never flew again. And the end result of that was he had advanced to getting very close to the end of the Flutter program on the prototype, and there was something like 8 or 10 flights left to do. And I ended up doing all of those. So I finished that program off, really for Jock, I suppose.
Sorting out the Flutter on the production aircraft, was that just a mechanical fix then, or what?
We didn't redo it. Oh yes, we did redo it on a production aircraft. Mm. Yes, well, we found out.
They didn't have to have these weights in every production aircraft.
Oh then, no. I mean, once you've done it on one aeroplane, you knew what the answer was. And I mean, let's just finish the story. What we discovered was, and you'll have to. If anybody looks up the books and the reports on this, they may find my figures are not absolutely dead right. But on the final Flutter flight, we did the Flutter tests at 18,500 feet. That's on a pressure altitude of that, which means a 10-13 setting on the millibar setting on the altimeter. At 18,500 feet, where you get the worst combination of speed and Mach number. In other words, that the two are the highest they can be at the same time. And we were flying at 18,500 feet at a speed, and I think I am right in saying this, of 443 knots indicated, and a Mach number... It might have been 0.93 or 0.95. It was high Mach number at 18,500 feet. Now that's a very high Mach number for that sort of an altitude, and a high speed. Now the true speed was what's the speed of sound at that height? About 700 miles an hour, and you're doing 0.93 or 0.95 of 700 miles an hour. So you aren't off skating along a bit for that height. And we ran the thing, but in the last series of flights, the last 12 or so flights, we were getting residual motion in the back of the aeroplane with two or three cycles before damping, you see. And this damping became less effective the faster you were going. And from this information, they could trace these things and they could extrapolate what was going to happen. And I think it was calculated that the back end would flutter at about 460 knots. So we got to within less than 20 knots of where it was going to flutter.
Of course, you exceeded Mark 1 on... Was that on the B2?
No, Mark 1. on the first... That was done on the first production aeroplane. First production Mark 1, XA 917.
And that was on a Sapphire part.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The Sapphires had a bit more oomph when they were on the production aeroplane. They were £11,000 by then instead of 9.5 or whatever they were on the production, on the prototypes.
You just slipped over the top, did you?
Or? Well, kind of yes, really. What happened was, for the first time, we were briefed to do some flight work at 0.98 up to 0.985 Mach number. Now, Up until that time, we hadn't ever been briefed to do anything over 0.96. And the Victor's as happy at these speeds. It's not taking any notice. The only thing about 0.985 was that you had to be in the Mark 1 in a very shallow dive to get it to go there. And I think the test height was 40,000 feet or 45, one of the two, I can't really remember. And whatever we were doing was all going very, very nicely, and there was no problem with it. But inevitably, when you're in a little bit of a dive, to get set on a precise Mach number, sometimes you'll slightly overdo it. And I'd had 0.99 indicated, you see, certainly, perhaps even a bit more than that. It was awfully close to one sitting on the indicator, this is, mark you. This is an indication, and you don't know really what sort of an error you might have on that indicator. But having completed our thing, I had a chat with the other two chaps in the aeroplane, both flight test observers. I didn't have another pilot on it. And said, look, you know, we're awfully close to this. Why don't we have a stab? And one of them was dead keen to go, and the other one wasn't quite so keen. He was the guy sitting at the back on the AEO's panel facing aft. And when you do something like this, I suppose people like to be able to see what's going on, I suppose. But anyway, he wasn't over keen, but we chatted him up a bit. And so we just approached from about 45,000 feet in a shallow dive with, I don't know whether I used full power or whether I used max continuous power. Can't remember. But anyhow, we just flew till it was indicating a bit over Mach 1, about 1.1 on the gauge. And
did you sense any pitch down at this time? Or not?
Absolutely nothing at all. You wouldn't... I mean, nothing happened. And because of it, I rather suspected we hadn't been supersonic, you see. And we actually did two runs. We did the first run... We were somewhere up over the Cambridge area. We did the first run heading out towards northeast from there, across East Anglia. But I thought, crikey, if we are supersonic, we're going to produce a bang, and that's really going to be the only way we're going to know. So it would be a very good thing if I could get a bang down on Radlett. But because you need such a shallow dive, you've got to stand back so far. It's not like a hunter or something. You stand it on its nose and point the bang straight down. You know you're going to hit wherever you're pointing at. And I thought, well, I don't know, I'm just going to have to make a guess at this. And so we more or less turned round and started to run straight back, pointing towards Radlett. And did the thing again, just the same, no, nothing different. And went home, because we'd finished, we'd done all our brief, we'd finished, went home, landed. We didn't say anything to anybody, we just waited in case someone might mention that there'd been a supersonic bang, but nothing was said at all. So after about 45 minutes or so, I couldn't really contain myself any longer, and I saw the air traffic chap, and I said, you didn't hear a supersonic bang at some time or another. No, he said, I haven't heard anything like that today. So I didn't say any more, I left it. And it was a Saturday. So nothing more happened, we all went home. And on the Monday morning, all our records were shipped into Cricklewood, where they were analysed and this, that and the other. And we warned them that, you know, we by this time we said, look, you know, we've done a fast run, just have a look at the records. And so the aerodynamics people, with great excitement, got at it. Oh, yes, they said, you made 1.015 or something. He said, enough to make a bang. And with this information, they went to see the chief designer and say, hey, you know, the Victor's supersonic. Oh, he said, that's interesting.
Who's that, Stafford?
No, Charles Joy. Uh-huh. Stafford got to know Ness. He was higher up the echelon. He was technical director, not chief designer. So the chief designer had to know first, you see. And
he said,
that's interesting. I was shopping in Watford just after 11 o'clock on Saturday morning, and there was a thundering great supersonic bang. Well, it was a precise time. And, of course, we'd overshot, well, our bang had overshot Radlett a little bit and clobbered Watford. And, I mean, that tied together with the results. Oh, yeah, we were supersonic.
You did trial drops. We've got about 10 minutes left. Is that all right?
Yeah, can we just hold for a second?
Going on to ask you, you were involved in airdrops of the dummy nuclear weapon.
Oh, yes.
There was a bit of pantomime surrounding that, wasn't it? Was that the Blue Danube?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was very early days, and we did that with the second prototype. Quite early on, as far as I was concerned, anyway, with the Victor. Yes, they couldn't bring the thing to Radlett because of security and this, that and the other. We had to take the aeroplane to Farnborough to have it loaded. And when we got to Farnborough, we had to taxi it inside a great big security fence, which was made of corrugated iron, so no one could see in. And the whole aeroplane was hidden inside this compound. And the crew were dismissed from the scene, and then they said, we'll load the aeroplane. And I said, well, I want to see what you're going to put in it. So I'm not going flying with something in an aeroplane I haven't seen and I don't know about. And there was a complete uproar about this. There's no need for you to see it, and yakety yakety yak. So anyhow, I persisted. I said, well, I'm not flying it. And so in the end, we got the whole crew were invited to go in and look. Well, what did we see? A big bomb, that's all it was, just a big bomb. And it was a dummy anyway, but just the shape of it was utterly secret. I don't know what people thought they were supposed to look like.
I mean, did it look like a tall boy or something, you know?
A tall boy was longer and slimmer, it was fat. Yeah. It was a very fat big bomb. Mm. Yes.
A bit like Fat Boy, the American.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Anyway, having seen it, yes, we went off and dropped it. It was an awful hoolie. We did three of them in the end. It was an awful hoolie dropping them. We had to drop them on a range at Orford Ness, and we could only drop them if there weren't any ships in the range. And although it was the designated danger area, merchant ships don't take too much notice of this sort of nonsense. If they want to go somewhere, they go the shortest way, and if it meant going through there, they went, you see. Well, the range was radar monitored, and if they could see ships in it, we weren't allowed to go and drop. And we'd have to sit at Farnborough and wait till they phoned and said, oh, yeah, if you're quick, you can get one off, you see. And so with a bit of hassle, we got the first two away. But when it came to the third one, we were messing about at Farnborough, I don't know, nearly all day, and they wouldn't clear us. And somebody in London, in the ministry part, started to get upset about this and saying, well, for goodness sake, this is ridiculous. And would you believe it? The ministry of whoever it was, supply then, I suppose, got back to Farnborough and authorised us to go and drop this thing free off the east end of the Isle of Wight after clearing the area ourselves. Well, I mean, it makes nonsense of all this business we've been going through at Orford Ness. If you could go and do it there once, why didn't we always do it? Anyhow, from our point of view, it was much more fun. We careered out with the bomb to the Isle of Wight, shot eastwards off the east end of the Isle of Wight, looked all about the sea, couldn't see anything, climbed to the height we were supposed to drop it from, and let it go, and then quickly turned round and were able to see the splash. That was it. So there's one of them lying somewhere in the English Channel now.
They made of just a lump of metal, were they?
Or? I suppose they were concrete, probably.
Concrete, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, they were all painted. They were black.
Yeah.
And that was it. And that was the end of that exercise, anyway. We did limited ordinary bomb dropping from the Victors, but the 36 bomb drop, was it 36 it was ultimately dropped? That was done, first of all, at Boscombe Down, and the Air Force later did some 36s. There are one or two.
Well, on Salisbury Plain, was it?
Or? Oh, they would have done them, yes, on one of the Salisbury Ranges.
Mm. Mm. That's a hell of a load, to
it. Well, yes.
Just let go in a short while.
Yes, the Victor, as you can well imagine, has got a pretty big bomb bay. Mm. In fact, our designers reckoned you could get more than 36 in if you tried a bit, but someone considered 36 would be enough. that was where it stayed. But it was, I don't know that any other aeroplane ever carried 36 1,000-pound bombs at all. A Vulcan.
B-52s did, of course, over Vietnam.
36 of them?
Quite a lot.
Did they? I'm surprised if
I don't know if they were in 1,000-pound units. They might... I remember seeing pictures of them just endlessly shouting.
Yes, I know. But that's because they dropped them in a different way. They sequenced them. You see, the 36 went out in one thing, and you could count all the bunches of six underneath the aeroplane if you got a good photograph of it. There are some, too. But I forget what the Vulcan dropped. 24 or something, I think, the Vulcan's 1,000-pound capacity was. Its bomb bay wasn't as big as a Victor, anyway. but the Victor's bomb bay was enormous, absolutely enormous.
And it was an incredible aeroplane because it was reincarnated as a tanker, wasn't it?
Well, yes.
For many years.
That, of course, the bomb bay lent that possibility too. You could put a hose drum unit in the back end of the bomb bay and two 4,000 imperial gallon tanks forward of that in the bomb bay, which added to the aeroplane's other fuel. I mean, it was a flying fuel bubble.
And you had those huge wing tanks. Well, had, well.
Yes, they each carried 1,750 gallons. I think they're probably the biggest drop tanks ever put on an aeroplane. Mm. So there was a dickens of a lot of fuel on it. Yeah. Yeah.
So you left-handed page, you know, when it went bankrupt or what?
Oh, yes, I stayed there till the end, and I know that everybody thinks the jet stream caused it. The jet stream didn't cause Handley Page to go bankrupt. What caused Handley Page to go bankrupt was that the ministry wouldn't give them the contract to convert the Mark II Victors into tankers. That's what stopped it.
Why not?
Because they wanted to get rid of Handley Page. It was the thing, you see. Handley Page hadn't joined up with anybody, any other part of the industry. And it was considered a good thing to get rid of it, and by withholding that contract, and they did. We had, I think, 20 of those Mark II Victors were there, mothballed for 15 months or so, waiting to go through the lines. And we'd done all the Mark I's, you see. I mean, the knowledge that was all there, we could have run through it very, very quickly. As it happened, because we were forced out of business, all of those aeroplanes had to come out of mothballs and be flown up to Woodford, because within 5 days of Handley Page going out of business, Woodford, Avros at Woodford were awarded the contract to do that Victor tanker thing. They wanted them that badly and urgently. But it took years to do it because they had no Victor knowledge up there. They had to reset everything for the Victor, get all the stuff out of Radlett and so on, ship it. The cost to the taxpayer must have been enormous by comparison with having it done at Handley Page. Absolutely enormous.
So it was a real conspiracy to
well, I think so. I mean, yeah. Yes, it has to be. Anyhow, I flew all of those Victors up to Woodford one at a time. And there they stayed, and after I'd finished that, I'd stayed involved with Jetstream for years, salvaging it, and it was really only as a result of of staying with it, and there were one or two others of it, that eventually it remained in service, and it was built by Scottish Aviation to start with for the Air Force and the Navy. And then when British Aerospace took them over, the whole thing really blossomed again. I mean, there was nothing wrong with the jet stream at all.